Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
The future of farms is the future of food. No Farms, No Future is a new podcast from American Farmland Trust and Heritage Radio Network. Listen today.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Eat Your Heartland Out with me, your host and tour guide, Capri Cafaro. Our show this hour is all about the Amana colonies in Iowa. You may have never heard of these seven villages, collectively referred to as the Amana colonies, but I guarantee after hearing their story, you'll want to discover more about them for yourself. German settlers came to the United States in the 19th century on a mission to preserve their religious freedom. From that commitment, the Amana colonies were born. Today, the Amana colonies showcase their German heritage and communal way of life through festivals, culinary practices, agricultural production, and the arts. We're joined by two guests who will give us a glimpse into life the Amana colonies way. Dana Jensen, events and social media manager for Amana Colonies Festival Incorporated, paints a colorful picture of everything the Amana colonies has to offer to visitors and locals alike. But first, we welcome John Childers, the executive director of the Amana Heritage Society, to explain the history of Amana and how it remains relevant to modern day life. John, thank you so much for joining the program. We're happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So a lot of folks may not be familiar with the Amana colonies. I just recently became aware of your unique community and its history. So let's start out by talking about, how did the Amana colonies start and what makes its history so special?
Well, first off, we are essentially a religious group, and we were founded in 1714 in Germany in the province of Hessen. We're a pietist group. The pietistic movement started in 1675, and a small band of these people all had similar beliefs, and they went around to pietist enclaves all over in Germany and built up sort of this outside of regular church membership. You were either a Catholic or you were a Lutheran in Germany. And at that time, there were starting to be these small splinter groups, and we were one of them. If you fast forward then to the 1840s, the group was not very large, maybe 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 at the most. And a number of them decided that, hey, we don't want to live in Germany anymore because we really can't. There's renewed religious intolerance and so forth. So they decided to live a communal lifestyle in America. So we came first starting in the 1840s to upstate New York by Buffalo, and then dissolved that whole community. It was called the Ebenezer Society, and then moved out here to Iowa beginning in 1855. And most all the people that were in Ebenezer had sold everything off there and made it out here by about 1863, 64. And then people continued to come from Germany. So essentially, being a communal religious society, people self-selected to be members of this. And they wrote for membership and asked to be members here for until about the 1890s. But essentially, they went to church 11 times a week together. They farmed the land together. Everybody had jobs that were assigned by the church elders, who were also the trustees of the business side of things. And they all decided that they would eat together. They had three meals plus two coffee breaks per day. And that was year round. Imagine it being like a neighborhood restaurant. We are a population of anywhere from 15 to about 1,800 people. And imagine in these small villages, none any larger than about 450, they would eat in neighborhood kitchens. There's one lady in charge of the kitchen. There's a vice boss. There were three young girls, so starting ages 14 to about age 20, 25, until they got married, they would cook and take turns washing dishes and serving people. Then there's a small group of ladies then who would be the prep ladies, and so they would prep vegetables. So there was all this idea about living sustainably on the land, living communally, and they lived that way until 1932, when an overwhelming vote by the community decided that they should change in order to remain a community, because the communal bonds were, and that structure was probably a little bit too rigid for what was coming up here in the 20s and 30s, which was a good thing, because we are still this group here that's still been perpetuating to this day.
It's an incredible story, and one that, you know, the fact that it sounds like the core value of the society is about this concept of communal living, and one that is carried out through, you know, the way that you work, as well as the way that you, you know, sustain yourself both economically as well as, you know, through food. And it's my understanding that, you know, the individual villages and the communities had focused on producing, you know, basically agricultural products and flour and the like for their own consumption, and then I think also sold. Give me a little bit more detail on this.
Okay. So essentially, when they came here, they bought 26,000 acres between 1855 and 1861. And at that point, they set up seven different villages, the smallest one being about a population of 125, and the largest one being about 450. Middle of Man and Amana were the largest villages, and they both had woolen production facilities in them. Mm-hmm. And the one woolen mill here in Amana is still running to this day. Mm. And Amana also had a calico factory. So they were very into production, but they also used agricultural inputs to be able to make those things happen for them. But all of the seven villages that were that are here all had farming districts of about 1,500 acres. And so from there, they managed crops, you know, corn and things like that, and all of the wheat and barley and things like that. And they also had cattle herds. They had pigs. We had up to 4,000 sheep at one time that supplied wool for the woolen mills. And so each village then was basically set up to be self-sustaining, with the exception of flour milling, which the village of Amana and the village of West Amana had their own flour mill, and they would grind the flour then for all seven villages. And then if you go again to sort of the micro level, this individual communal kitchen that was in each one of the neighborhoods, roughly, for instance, here in the village of Amana, where I am today, there were 16 communal kitchens. In the village where I live, where I grew up, Middle Amana, there were nine there. And in one of the smaller villages like East Amana, there were only four village kitchens there. And so if you can imagine, they had, there was a dairy herd in each village, so they would deliver dairy there a couple times a week. They'd deliver flour a few times a month, and they would then produce food then at that site, where they would, you know, they would make butter, they would make three different kinds of cheeses, they would do some baking there, and there were village bakers that supplied larger supplies of bread and different things like that throughout the year to them. So it was basically an economy surrounded by agriculture, but then also producing enough for the outside world. They did produce a few agricultural products that were sold out outside, but also the woolens and the calico were used to, and there was also a big lumber yard and some other larger industries that helped foot the bill then, you know, to make the sale so they could continue this perpetuated communal lifestyle.
I was just going to ask as a follow-up, because I'm curious about how this actually functioned. You know, when you, it, you know, you have sort of sounds like you have two sides of this. One is for the consumption of the residents and the community. And the other is, as you said, is for the outside. And so, you know, you would make sales of these goods to the outside. How in the concept of communal living would those funds be utilized? Would they be just reinvested, for example, in the flour mill, or would those funds be distributed to pay the individuals that were working in that factory? How did that work? I'm just curious.
Essentially, everything went into a common fund, and there were different, each different village, like Amana had a different focus than Homestead did. Homestead was our ship point. So all the woolens, all the calico, all of that came in and out of that village. And South Amana, for instance, Upper South in particular, railway went through there beginning the 1880s. So then they built about four or five houses up there, and they built a large lumber yard. So they would end up, you know, running a lot of their lumber in and out of that point. But essentially each village, then money would come into the common fund and the people were not paid in cash, but in credit. So you would go to your village general store. And so say, you know, we all, you know, lived here at one point before 1932, my family would have so much credit. My family might be a little bit larger, a little bit smaller than yours. So I might have $50 or $80 of credit. You might have, you know, 30 or 40 or, you know, whatever it is. And that money was simply used to purchase goods that were brought into the local general store. And also, if you got married, the family, then the new husband and wife would want, say, a sofa. They would want a piece of furniture. They would then go to that village where they lived. They would go to the craftsperson there and say, we'd like to have a couch made. And then that would then be credited to them at the store. So there was a very deep accounting system here. And as a matter of fact, the communal kitchens themselves, the ladies who ran these, the communal kitchen bosses, it went up every Thursday and they would do all of their purchasing through the village general store. They would buy coffee and tea and different things like that that were not produced here. But then they would also sell some of their surplus to other villages as well. So that was all being accounted. And there was no cash that was exchanged, but they were expected to at least not be in the red at the end of the year. So they would always have to do some things, you know, so in particular at the end of the year. But all the money, at the macro level, all the money that came in went to the common fund, and it was used then just to continue to pay the bills for the group as a whole. Individuals are not supposed to be making money on their own in any way.
Before we continue our conversation with John Childers, he was kind enough to share a recording of a hymn that was at one of their church services, one that he actually was in attendance for back in 2004 at the Middle Amana Church, Middle Amana being one of the villages that comprise the Amana colonies in Iowa. As you've been hearing, faith and the church are very important to the Amana communities, which is why I think it's relevant to bring in some music, this hymn, to get a greater understanding the context of the Amana community and the importance that the church plays and the importance of the German language and tradition. It's my understanding, actually, that there weren't even hymnals in English until the mid-1990s. This piece you're about to hear is entitled in German, so please forgive me. German is not a language I know. It is called Das Abre Sonne Licht, which roughly translates to the visible light of the sun. Take a listen.
So wollen wir dann in Gottes Namen unsere Versammlung anfangen mit dem Lied Das äußere Sonnenlicht auf der Seite 106, hymn number 115.
We've been listening to a clip of a hymn from an Amana Colony church service from the Middle Amana Church in Iowa. And we've been speaking with John Childers, the executive director of the Amana Heritage Society, about the history of the Amana colonies and its culture. When we return, we continue our exploration of the relationship between communal kitchens, faith, and the Amana colonies of today.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to Eat Your Heartland Out. This hour, we're spotlighting the unique cultural and culinary heritage of the Amana colonies in Iowa. We've been discussing how German immigrants established a communal way of living that remains relevant today. John Childers, executive director of the Amana Heritage Society, is still with us. Let's welcome him back to the show. And we are still chatting with John Childers, the executive director of the Amana Heritage Society, who has been telling us about this community and its deep roots in communal living in Iowa, and dating all the way back to their inception in Germany. John, we were talking about kind of the communal economy as well as this concept of these communal kitchens. You mentioned how the women that were running them, you know, kind of pulled their resources to get the goods that weren't produced in the community. But tell us more about how these communal kitchens worked. You know, I know that there were a number in each village, but bring us into the kitchen. Give us a perspective on what it might have been like, prior to the 1930s.
Great. That's a wonderful question. And that's probably what I'm the very best at. We actually own the only intact communal kitchen that was, that remains from that time, one of 55 communal kitchens that we had. And I was raised in one. As a matter of fact, my great grandmother was the last kitchen boss in the home where I live. So essentially, as I mentioned earlier, there was one woman and her family, who were assigned to be, she was the communal kitchen boss. In some cases, it was a mother and a daughter. Sometimes it was a daughter and her elderly mother who would be the kind of the co-bosses. In the case of my great-grandmother, it was just she, but then her husband, my great-grandfather, and her two kids then would live in a part of the house. And then there was another family that lived in a different part of the house. And then the communal kitchen was basically a wing on this residence. And it had in it a large kitchen with a hearth, and it had a baking oven, and it also had some wood stoves in it and a cooking stove. And they had then a vice boss who would be sort of, she was the second in charge. I would almost call her a communal kitchen boss in training. And all the children, both boys and girls, went to school here only until eighth grade. And at that time, they would matriculate. They would have to pass a county exam. And from that point on, the boys mostly ended up on the farms, or if they were in one of the villages with the woolen mills, they'd end up in the woolen mill for a time until they were kind of retrained or they were left in there according to their skills. The young girls, and would end up going working at the communal kitchens. And they would get up every morning at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, go to the kitchen. Many of the kitchens had a hired man. This would be a non-society person. There were about 400 day laborers who lived here at any one time, helping in the mills, helping. As a matter of fact, the communal kitchen that we own is called the Reedy Communal Kitchen. There was a hired man who lived upstairs in the woodshed, and he just lived in one small room. He'd get up in the morning, he'd light all the stoves for the three young girls to come in. They would start to fry potatoes or, you know, something like that, and make the coffee and get things ready. And then by the time it was, 6 o'clock or 6:30, then the villagers would be coming to that particular kitchen, the 30 to 40 that were assigned to eat there. In theory, we always interpret that people ate in the kitchens. In practice, that was not always the case. If you had a young family, you were allowed to take your meals home with you. And if you were taking care of elderly parents, or let's say that you lived in a home where there were other families living in there, it might be an elderly couple, they were no longer healthy enough to get out, you might be able to go and bring food to them or whatever. In German, they were always called die Heimholer, the ones who take their food home. And so they would then, the people would eat that in the morning, and they really kind of carb loaded. They fried potatoes, they ate bread and butter, syrup, things like that for breakfast. You know, we're not talking bacon and eggs and anything like that. Then everybody went to work. They would then have a mid-morning a break where they would have maybe some kind of Handkäse, which is this sort of hand-molded cheese, or they would have brick cheese or something like that, a piece of bread and some coffee. And then when it was 11:30, at least in the village where I grew up, that was the dinner bell would ring about 15 minutes before that. The people then would show up for their meals at 11:30, and the three young girls had already cleaned up the breakfast dishes and cleaned up from serving, and they had to turn around and make lunch then. While at the same time, there were four or five of these prep ladies that would be either sitting outside or sitting inside somewhere. They'd be prepping potatoes and doing green beans. They would be putting vegetables up, you know, and canning and things like that. They made apple butter. They made their own butter, of course. They made the three different kinds of cheeses that were made here traditionally.
Which are what?
The one is called Schmierkäse. It's like a spreadable cheese. I call it German queso. It's got a white color. It's got caraway seed in it. It's very kind of, with the caraway seed, gives it kind of a pungent-y flavor. Then there was this Handkäse that I was mentioning. It's basically taking the curds and mushing them together really hard, getting all the liquid on that you can and mixing them with some salt and making them into little hockey pucks that are very similar to Gouda cheese. And then you have to let them ripen. And then the final one was a brick cheese that they made. And there's still brick cheese that's made in Wisconsin. I know that they carry some of those cheeses here in the Amanas. And so they would produce a lot of these, you know, foods here on the ground in each one of the communal kitchens. And they all did have about 200 to 300 chickens in them. So they were, you know, constantly eating chicken. They were collecting the eggs and most every vegetable that they made. They were not done the healthy way like we had like to have them today, being steamed. They were typically creamed, you know, in butter and flour and cream and all that. And most of the ironic thing is most of our old timers lived to be very, very old in their mid-80s. Somebody passed away in their mid-80s. It was kind of a tragedy. So most of the people were living, you know, in modern times, the ones that had lived communally were living into their 90s very easily. So after lunchtime, anyway, the young girls would get done cleaning up afterwards, and then they'd be able to go home for a few hours before they came back at about 3:30, 4 o'clock, and they would start to either fry potatoes or make potato dumplings or do something like that. The kitchen boss, the vice boss were overseeing quite a bit of the operation, but also taking care of teaching those girls how to cook. This is what somebody had told me, if I can just make an aside very quickly. Most regular people, you know, a farm family living 5 miles from the Amanas in 1890 or 1920 or whatever year it was, young girls, we're talking about traditional society, young girls were in the homes with their mothers or grandmothers or their aunts learning how to do these things in the kitchen. Of course, the boys are outside learning how to do the chores and, you know, all the stuff that men are supposed to do. But in the Amanas, the young kids weren't seeing a lot of that. If you were a young boy doing a boy job someday, you weren't going to the cooper shop. You weren't going to the blacksmith shop. You were kind of just herded around in a different way. And the young girls were not spending that much time in the kitchens. So they all had to learn how to cook when they were 14. And most of the ladies who would be in my grandmother's generation said, we didn't know anything about cooking. We're 14. We graduated from 8th grade and plop, we're there in the kitchen and having to feed all these people. We had no idea what we were doing. So it always took a while for them to be able to train.
So were they just going to regular school, so to speak, you know, to the 8th grade and not necessarily, you know, engaging in these kind of chores?
Correct.
Whether they're gendered chores or not, they are just basically kind of doing their thing until they're 14 and then kind of brought back into fulfilling these more traditional work roles that, you know, may sometimes have a gender association.
Yes. Now, they would have gone out to onion fields as school kids, and they would have, they used the school kids a lot as labor. So they would go.
The village,
yes, because and the church elders ran each village. So they were both the ministers in the church, and they were also sort of the trustees of the village that were making sure everybody's getting to work and that the accounts were all paid and, you know, all that stuff. So every spring and summer and fall when they were taking care of the onions there. I mean, there's actually a photo of the kids in Middle of Man about 1920, something like that, 1922, of a big row of them. And they're all out sort of cultivating the onions in these large fields that were about 3 or 4 acres large that they would cultivate the onions. And later on, the potato harvest would happen and they would use some of the kitchen girls for that. And actually some of the younger kids as well. And so the kids always had to work, but they weren't really learning. I mean, so I'm 50, and I didn't end up learning how to cook until I was in my early mid 20s. And you know, my wife doesn't like to cook, and I do, but I didn't know how high to turn the heat on in the pans and all that. So I mean, I kind of try to live vicariously through them, thinking what less would I have known at 14 than I did at 25. It took me about 5 years to be able to cook anything. So I kind of feel for that, you know, feel for them.
Sure. And you know, some things have changed, but some things have remained in culturally in the community there in the Amana villages. I know that there was something, I think it was called the Great Change. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Or the, yes.
What was that? And then what happened after the Great Change?
So the group that wanted to become communal, were the grandparents and great grandparents of some of the people that were living in the teens and 20s. And there was a group of young men, and they would have become leaders regardless if they would have remained communal or not. And the case was that most of them did remain in leadership. But in about 1926, they all sat in a room right down the street from where I'm sitting, and they were all related by blood or marriage. And they said, "What do you guys see out the window?" And they said, "We see a couple hundred of our contemporaries no longer living in the Amanas." They were living in small towns like ours nearby. Some of them were living in Cedar Rapids. Some of them had moved to Davenport, Iowa, which is a large mm-hmm. German area, and everywhere in between. And they said, you know, it isn't that they're against living communally, and it isn't that they're against our religious beliefs. And I have to say this as an aside, our communal living has nothing to do with what our religious beliefs are. It was a way to accommodate 2,600 people coming from Germany, Northern Switzerland, and Alsace. Yes. And so these young men ended up saying, you know, we need to approach our fathers, the trustees of the church and the communal society, and beg them that we need to make a change. So they went to them and they said, you know, we see all of our contemporaries, we're not going to have a society. We're not going to stay together as a community. And that was the main purpose for them to leave Germany, was to build a community and to become a community. And so they said, yes, we observe the same thing, but we're too old and don't know, I'm paraphrasing, but we don't know exactly what to do about this. Our ways are very steep in the communal ways. Most all of you have been outside. You know, some of them were learning English, some of them were had attended college and things like that, because they were going to be the next generation of leadership. So what they proposed then was to get together with a proportionate number of people from all 7 villages, the number ended up being 47. So each village voted on a certain amount of people that created this committee, then called the Committee of 47. And these were people, some of them had participated in World War I. They were pacifists, but yet we were sort of swept up into the war too as conscientious objectors. Some of them who were not living here at the time ended up getting swept up as people who went into combat. And again, we were always pacifists. Some of them had, again, trained in college. Some of them had lived away for a while, just didn't like it here. And what they end up doing is getting together, saying, what are our values? You know, the church, we mm-hmm. want the church to go on as it was, but what are other values? How do we make, if we change, how do we make it equitable for everyone? Now, originally, there were about 4 families that put all of their tremendous wealth into the Ebenezer Society, then eventually that transferred to the Amana Society. Well, those people, of course, were guaranteed to get their money back, but the vast majority of the 2,600 immigrants who came here had nothing. So they said, well, but these people and their parents and their grandparents all built something. So what they did is that this Committee of 47 met a number of times, and then eventually it went down to a committee of about 10. So the bigger committee was like a steering committee. And the values were this: they wanted to assure that everyone here would have a job. They wanted to assure everyone would have a home. They wanted to assure that everyone would have insurance, and also be able to keep everybody here as a community. So once that was all started being in motion, some of those kids living outside, the 20-some-year-olds that were sort of lost and wanted to do more, they were starting to come back because they knew that things were going to change. So that was one good thing. So that committee of 10 then really kind of went to work, and they did all of this. They talked to lawyer, to a particular lawyer, and that lawyer helped walk them through exactly what they needed to do. So in the end, everyone was guaranteed to live in a home. There were two types of stock that were given out. One was a Class A share. The other one was a prior distributive share. The Class A share gave you a medical benefit. It also gave you a membership to the New Amana Society, which is still in operation today. And it allowed you to vote for directors every year. So
let me just stop you real quick right there, because we're running a little bit out of, we're getting close to the end of our time together. And, you just mentioned that the New Amana Society is still in existence today. Mm-hmm. So in a little bit of time we have left, I'd like to know what remains today, almost 100 years after the change, the great change in the 1930s, mm-hmm. what remains in the Amana colonies and, from a cultural standpoint, more specifically, and how has some of this communal, particularly communal kitchens, communal eating, how is that, maintained as part of the culture in 21st century Amana colonies?
Okay, well, number one, again, they wanted to, so this whole great change happened so they could remain together as a community. When I was a child growing up, the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, 80 to 90% of people who lived here had a communal background. Their parents, they themselves, or grandparents, whatever, were here. So the community has remained together. Our church is still here, and it still thrives. The Amana Society Incorporated is that for-profit joint stock corporation that still manages the business affairs. We still own 26,000 acres here that's divided between the farmland and timberland. We've got Iowa's largest timber reserve. We're really trying to get into sustainable agriculture, and we have the a large methane digester that supplies power for all 1,600 residents. Yes.
Yeah.
And if you kind of, and we do have a number of heritage businesses, our woolen mill that the guys, those four families incorporated in 1840 still exists. We also have our Amana Meat Shop here, which they make they create our dinners for our communal dinners that we serve today as a museum. It has been in continuous operation since 1857. So it is still here. The Amana General Store has never closed down for a day. And there are a number of restaurants. I mean, we've got about 40 or 50 small businesses here in town. And some of the restaurants that are here are actually part of that they were originally communal kitchens. So those families continued to offer dinners, but they did it for profit. And, it's all family style dining now. But as far as the culture goes, again, the church remains. A number of us here still speak German, to this day. It's getting fewer and fewer all the time. The Amana Heritage Society, our organization, tries to keep people together. There are many, many Amana people living throughout the rest of the country and some living in Europe, and we try to stay together and keep those cultural ties together. We have an arts guild. They practice a lot of folk art here, and a lot of those things. Our latest tinsmith or last tinsmith that we've had passed away. We've got two people that are working on that he taught that are trying to keep that going. We have carpet weavers. We have potters. We have the whole nine yards here. And these are people that grew up here. These are people that are continuing those traditions. And as far as the food, I would say there's 30, 40 households that are still out of a population of 1,600 that are still producing or making that traditional food. When I was a kid, everybody made it. It was boring. Nobody wanted to have, some of that old stuff. But, today it's actually kind of a treat to be able to have it. So we're sustaining. It's not quite at the level we'd love to have it, but there is still a lot of evidence of that original communal culture that's still here.
Well, I am inspired. I think that's a great place for us to leave our conversation, because we're also going to be joined by one of your colleagues from Amana as we continue our show, who's going to tell us about all the different festivals that are bringing people together and continuing on some of these traditions, particularly food traditions. So, John, thank you very much for taking the time, and I certainly do hope to get a chance to go out there and visit.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks for having us.
Stick around for more Eat Your Heartland Out after these messages. When we come back, our next guest is going to tell us all about
the fairs and festivals that are offered year-round in the Amana colonies.
The future of farming in America is uncertain. Our farmers are aging and selling off their land. But the pandemic has revealed the importance of local farms as the national and international supply chain continues to be disrupted.
I mean, it's not like most farmers have a company-sponsored retirement plan.
I'm Hannah Forden, HRN's program manager, and I want to tell you about a new show. Hosted by John Piotti, the president and CEO of American Farmland Trust, and produced in collaboration with Heritage Radio Network, this is No Farms, No Future. There is a new generation of small farmers. We're here to tell their stories, share knowledge, and dig deep into the future of American farming. From land stewardship,
we are losing 2,000 acres of farmland a day.
The price of land is often so high that it's really hard to get started.
To cracks in the supply chain.
By the time I go shopping every single day, there's no meat left to feed my family.
The future of farms is the future of food. Subscribe to No Farms, No Future, a new podcast from American Farmland Trust and Heritage Radio Network. Find us wherever you like to listen.
You're listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. We're now joined by Dana Jensen, event and social media manager for the Amana Colony Festivals Incorporated. Dana, we're happy that you could join Eat Your Heartland Out today to tell us a little bit more about the Amana colonies of the 21st century and everything you have to offer. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So it's my understanding that the Amana colonies have a number of festivals throughout the year. Give us a snapshot of maybe running from, you know, sort of the beginning of the year to the end of the year. What's on offer? And then maybe we'll get a little bit more into detail on each one.
Yeah, so we have five major festivals throughout the year, and then we have several smaller events. We start every year out with Winterfest right away in January, which in Iowa is a little cold. But we still have a lot of fun. They serve open fire chili and lots of cocoa and Heights cider to keep everyone warm. Then we have a kind of a Valentine's Day special weekend where we do a lot of dinner specials. We have Dumpling Day in March, which is exactly what it sounds like, in a day for everything dumplings. In April, we have our big food festival, which is called Take a Bite. And that leads us right into MyFest, which is our second major festival. Then things pick up pretty quickly from there. We have tons of different festivals throughout the summer. Worst Fest is, Amana Colony's Worst Festival, I should say, is our biggest event in the summer. It is a day dedicated to all things bratwurst and sausage and locally made sausages at that. And that kind of takes us right on through. We keep having major events. We have an Apple Festival. Oktoberfest obviously happens every year, which is our biggest festival by far. And then we finish the year off with our last major festival, which is Prelude to Christmas in Tannenbaum Forest.
Wow. Well, you have quite a bit to attract tourism into your region. What kind of folks, you know, visit the Amana colonies? I mean, is it more of a regional draw or, you know, do people come from all over the country or at least the Midwest?
It really kind of depends on what we have going on in town. We certainly attract people from all over the country, sometimes all over the world come here to visit. We have one of the largest Oktoberfests in the country, definitely one of the premier Oktoberfests of the entire Midwest, which is pretty saying a lot given that we are a small community of about 12,000 people. 2021, we attracted over 60,000 people for our Oktoberfest weekend.
Wow. Well, so you mentioned Oktoberfest, and I wanted to kind of bring this up to both Worst Fest and Oktoberfest, and connect them back to, you know, kind of the origins and the heritage of the Amana colony. So close that loop for us and our listeners.
Yeah, so we are seven little German villages. We were a communal society. We kind of made everything here in-house up until 1932 when we went through the Great Change and ended communal life. And so we try and bring a lot of those things back into all of our festivals. So Wurstfest and Oktoberfest, we serve bratwursts that are made here by the Amana Meat Shop and Smokehouse. They have been in operation since, I believe, 1855, if I remember correctly. I might be off a year or two, but they've been in operation pretty much since we've been here.
A long time.
Yes. And they still make everything kind of, they make all your traditional Amana sausages. They try new things out all the time. So they're kind of our spearhead for both our Oktoberfest bratwurst, and they're the biggest competition for our Wurst Festival, best of the worst competition. They have won, I think, 7 years in a row now. Last year, I believe it was the dill pickle bratwurst that they made that won. So they are very stiff competition still. They do a lot with our keeping our traditional bratwurst, our traditional food culture alive, especially regards to bratwurst and sausage making.
So, you know, obviously what you're describing with these, you know, villages, they're German villages, obviously settled by German immigrants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is why it's always really interesting to hear these stories about, you know, how festivals in particular, you know, continue to carry on traditions and educate not only future generations, but different audiences about, you know, a community and its origins and its heritage, and doing that through food. Speaking of food, again, you know, this is a show about food and culture. Dumpling Fest, and you said it is what it sounds like. Everything dumplings. What kind of dumplings are we talking? I mean, is this like chicken and dumplings, or is this pierogies? Like, what are we talking about when you talk dumplings in this context?
Yeah, so Dumpling Day is going to be our second Dumpling Day ever. So it started last year as a kind of a last year we had no events or festivals going on in March, and we thought we should add something in to try and get people into the Amana colonies in one of our slower months, because it's still cold in Iowa in March.
Yep.
So we added Dumpling Day in, and it really is anything goes as long as it can be related to dumplings in some way, shape, or form. So we obviously offer your traditional German dumplings. I know last year the meat shop had a bockwurst dumpling that they sold out on because it was delicious. We have had pierogies. We've had Asian-inspired dumplings. It really doesn't matter kind of what culture it comes from, as long as you can bring a dumpling in some way, shape, or form. So you'll notice that a lot of our restaurants will have specials going on with different dumplings from around the world.
Wow. I mean, that definitely makes me want to go. I mean, who doesn't love dumplings? I really love the Amana colony story is so unique, and one that I think is, you know, maybe not known by a lot of people, maybe even in the state of Iowa. So, you know, the fact that you have a number of these festivals that are attracting people in, you know, has to be, you know, I think really eye-opening to a lot of folks that this is this, you know, community that had this communal culture for, you know, up until, you know, the early 20th century, and then, you know, things, you know, evolved and changed. What else, you know, if we were to visit Amana colonies outside of the festivals, you know, are there any kind of, you know, unique attractions or, you know, cultural experiences that one could take advantage of if they were going to go visit?
Yeah, we have tons of different things that people can do when they come here, whether or not we have a festival going. From May to October, we run historic van tours that travel around through the seven villages. You hit all villages but East Amana, and you get to see several different historical sites, including the last remaining communal kitchen that's still intact. Which is a really unique experience. You kind of get to see how they ate their meals, which is very different to what we would expect in most societies, because everyone ate in one room. You had about 40 people crammed into this tiny little room. So in addition to the tours, mm-hmm. we obviously have great craftsmen here who still make things from hand. We have two furniture shops that you can actually observe during the week that still make everything from hand by scratch. We have the oldest textile mill and the only textile mill left in the state, which is the Amana Colonies Woolen Mill, and their showroom, the Warped and Woven Mill Mercantile. They actually are the, I believe, the oldest business in Amana because they actually started in Germany and they brought it all the way here to Amana. Yeah, so they've been in operation for a very long time. In addition to that, we do also have the oldest microbrewery in the state, as well as the oldest continuously operated winery, which would be Ackerman. They were in 1956. Not the oldest winery in the state, but that honor also goes to Amana.
Well, so with wine in the region, I mean, is it also inspired by German tradition, like Riesling and things of that nature?
Prohibition ended in the state. So we were very quick. We've been making wine since 1855. We were very quick to get on that that boat and become an official winery. They, unfortunately, are no longer in operation.
Wow. I've never heard of rhubarb wine.
Yes and no. So we certainly have some wineries now that have more of your kind of what you would think of German winery, Gerstenmeiners and Rieslings. Traditionally in Amana, there were three types of wine, and it would have been rhubarb wine, which is by far our biggest seller across the board today still.
There has to be strawberry rhubarb pie, right?
Yes, we are known for our rhubarb wine. we have actually a rhubarb festival in the summer as well, where we spend all that time kind of hyping up the rhubarb because in Amana, rhubarb was a major food source. We have our own word for it. Always. There's always strawberry rhubarb pie. It doesn't matter the season. There's always rhubarb pie here in Amana. But we have our own word for it called Pie Stingel.
Right.
Which loosely translates from the English word pie and the German word for stalk, which is Stingel. And I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. German's not my forte, but it was a uniquely Amana word that meant essentially rhubarb wine and rhubarb. So that has been around forever. The other two wines would have been Concord grape and Catawba grape.
Well, and I can tell you from what I know, because I come from actually a wine region in Ohio, and I've done some work on and some research on this. I mean, you know, those are exactly the grapes that kind of grow in this climate here. So a lot of times the wine is adapting in that manner. So interesting. I mean, now what I want to know is, you know, is this something that you can go and just consume, like, you know, if you are going to go, you know, to, you know, a winery, can you tour it? Or is it just, you know, tasting? Or if you're going to go to the mill, is it, you know, do you just purchase products? Or is this something that you can actually do sort of a behind the scenes, you know, tour, or maybe do experience travel through weaving? You talked about weaving, that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, if I love experiential travel, and I would love to know if those are the kind of things that you'd be able to do as well.
Yeah, so in the past, I know that the Woolen Mill has offered like kind of behind the scenes tours. I know that during COVID, they had to halt that. I believe that they are trying to bring it back as soon as they can, but they obviously have some concerns for safety of their staff, and they are in a new building. So you do get to see some of that experience and see the kind of looms and things. I just don't know if they are currently able to offer tours, but that is something they have done in the past and they are wanting to do again. So there definitely is a chance for that more experiential learning. The Amana Arts Guild often does classes, especially in the summer, where you can learn different things. Right now we have a kind of a knitting club where we're taking that kind of the woolen yarns and things like that and crocheting and knitting them. That happens at one of the restaurants here in town every week, where they have locals and anyone who wants to join can come and just knit and crochet and make little projects.
How cool.
So there's still a big community kind of participation involved in everything that we do. We try and do as much as we can, and we're always trying to add new things and more experience type options as well.
Well, I love the fact that you're blending, you know, something like, you know, a communal space like a restaurant with, you know, some of these, you know, crafts and activities. You don't really hear about something like that in your, you know, traditional destination. What's next for the Amana Colonies? What's on the horizon? You know, any new festivals planned, changes to your tours, anything that you'd like our audience to know about what you have coming up?
I say immediately coming up, we have the biggest festival I'm working on right now is MyFest, which is often mispronounced as Mayfest, but it's MyFest. which we have a lot of our heritage, but we also try and make that celebration a multicultural celebration of all of Iowa. So we bring different dance troupes. I know for sure we're going to have some Irish dancers. We're looking at some other different dance troupes to come in and share cultural dances with us, in addition to our own MyPol dancers. And then we always have the World on Wheels food truck that goes along, rodeo that goes along with that. So we bring in different food trucks that offer a different variety of cuisine, non-German foods. The Heritage Society also does a traditional kind of food stand where they serve potato pancakes and things like that that would have been served, you know, back in Germany when we were there, and then also in communal times. So we always try and do things like that for MyFest and really just branch out and share the joys of all of the unique heritage here in Iowa, not just in the Amana colonies.
Wow. I mean, and you know, you have so much related to food. And you just mentioned the food trucks and, you know, obviously you have your dumpling days and then Wurstfest. And I know I want to just kind of circle back before I let you go about the Valentine's Day and Christmas time, because I feel like chocolate has to be involved in all of that somewhere.
Yes. So we have a great little shop here called The Chocolate House. That's H-A-U-S.
Of course.
Yep. Got to stick with that German theme. They make all of their chocolate in-house, and they always, for Valentine's, have an amazing selection. I know that they are working on fresh-dipped chocolate strawberries and tons of different Valentine's goodies. So they are always a great place for Valentine's Day. The other things that we do for – it's called Romance Weekend is the event that we do. We have a chocolate and beer pairing this year.
Oh, wow.
So the brewery has partnered with the Chocolate House to provide a little tasting flight of their beers perfectly paired with some of the Chocolate House chocolates and their truffles and their fudge and all the fun goodies. So we do a lot with that. And then there's always several wine dinners that go on. White Cross Cellars and the Okshok do what they call a vintner's dinner, where it's a specially prepared, unique menu.
Yes.
That's only available for that dinner. It's not something that the Okshok ever does on their regular menu. It's all brand new for just that dinner. And then they pair that with wines from the White Cross Cellars. There is a chocolate and wine pairing as well as a cheese and wine pairing at some of our other wineries here in town, Ackerman and Fireside. So there's lots of different food experiences to have with your special someone.
This sounds incredible, and I am so glad that we're sharing your story with our audience, who I know loves this kind of thing, learning about new cultures, new destinations, and uncovering the uniqueness of parts of the American Midwest. Dana, thank you for sharing with us, and I look forward to maybe hopefully getting out there and going on one of those van tours and experiencing all that the Amana Colonies has to offer. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.